From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now. We're learning more now about how unprepared the U.S. Capitol Police were in the days leading up to and during the insurrection on January 6th. In a 104-page report, Michael Bolton, the Capitol Police Inspector General, detailed his assessment of the agency's failures. He says the agency had a fractured assessment of intelligence and that officers didn't have access to necessary equipment. Today, Bolton is testifying before the House Administration Committee. And let's bring in NPR congressional correspondent Claudia Grisales with more. Thank you for joining us, Claudia.
Thanks for having me.
So only portions of Bolton's report have been released to NPR, and NPR has reviewed some of those so far, and they're pretty damning. Bolton explains that Capitol Police were made privy to explicit threats by rioters days before the insurrection, and they made it clear that the Capitol was a target. Why weren't these threats taken seriously?
Yes, he said in this extensive report, and I should note that portions have been made public, but the entire report, one of these, it's 104 pages, as you mentioned, is law enforcement sensitive, and we were able to obtain that, and we've looked through it. And it said that Capitol Police had this fragmented approach to handling intelligence, and as a result, findings such as these threats that you mentioned were buried. This includes alarming details in their own analysis before January 6th that said Trump supporters saw January 6th as their last chance to overturn the election. It also said there was a sense of desperation and disappointment that could fuel violence. And the analysis went on to say that, quote, Congress itself is the target on the 6th. And they said this intelligence wasn't shared in a streamlined fashion to the right people.
I want to remind folks, days before the attack, some Trump supporters reportedly posted photos of the Capitol's tunnel system to message boards. Why was that overlooked in this report?
This is part of the same issue that Bolton points out about how this approach to gathering and sharing this intelligence was very fragmented. It didn't get to the right places. It didn't get highlighted with the right level of priority. And even in their own analysis, Capitol Police had documented conversations in social media about how these tunnels are used by members and perhaps rioters could find the members there. And some of these plans were laced with some elaborate threats, too. And so Bolton uses that point to highlight how the agency had this critical information in hand, but did not proceed in such a fashion to respond if the rioters were indeed trying to breach the Capitol and wreak havoc that day.
Bolton also explains that officers were instructed by leaders to use weapons that weren't as lethal, and that the equipment they had access to, like riot shields, were so inadequate that they shattered upon impact. He also says Capitol Police did not prioritize the civil disturbance unit. Why is that last detail important?
This unit responds to emergencies. This is the day when they would have been on deck. Their priority would have been shutting down this breach, such as what we saw that day. They were overwhelmed and overpowered. Bolton says the agency has run this unit in such a way that it was disorganized. They didn't have adequate policies and procedures to define their responsibilities. They were operating at a decreased level of readiness in terms of lack of standards for equipment, and they had a lapse in certain certifications and staffing concerns, and also quarterly audits that were not performed. And also a majority of their officers in this unit had not completed required annual training for the last several years. So very long list in terms of how they should have been prioritized to better prepare for what we saw that day.
Claudia, I just have under a minute with you. How are members of Congress reacting to this report?
So some have said that while this report is disheartening, it's not surprising. As one congressman noted to me, this is Democrat Tim Ryan of Ohio, whose committee oversees Capitol Police. He says this shows that the rank-and-file members were betrayed by their leaders. And this is just the beginning, he notes, of these probes. And so there's more to come. This also ramps up pressure to reform the agency and take up a supplemental security funding bill to better support these officers and security at the Capitol. Just today, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said she wants that legislation to get taken up soon, so it looks like it could come up later this month.
Claudia Grisales is NPR's congressional correspondent, as always. Thank you so much.
Thanks much.
Well, President Biden now has less than 5 months to carry out his plan to end the longest war in American history. At the White House yesterday, Biden explained his decision to pull out of Afghanistan by September 11th.
We already have service members doing their duty in Afghanistan today whose parents served in the same war. We have service members who are not yet born when our nation was attacked in 9/11. War in Afghanistan was never meant to be a multi-generational undertaking.
Of course, his predecessor, President Trump, planned a faster pullout, but his fellow Republican Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell opposed Trump's pullout and opposes Biden's, which he calls a grave mistake. And our next guest, a Democrat, said she was disappointed in Biden's plan. New Hampshire Senator Jean Shaheen serves on the Foreign Relations Committee. She joins us now. And Senator Shaheen, lay out your concerns about the Biden drawdown.
I am very worried about what the potential fallout will be in terms of the Afghan people because of the strength of the Taliban. It puts Afghans who have been partners with the United States at real risk. I've worked for years on the special immigrant visa program to try and help those Afghans who have risked their lives to support the United States. The Afghan women and girls will also be very vulnerable, as well as ethnic minorities. I was in Afghanistan a couple of years ago, and I had a chance to meet with a number of Afghan women. And I was impressed with how thoughtful they were about the need to end the war in Afghanistan. And they said, look, this has been going on for 40 years, and we understand that the Taliban are going to have some role in what happens next. But what we don't want is to see that our rights that have been written into the Afghan constitution are going to be undermined, and that we are going to go back to what it was like when the Taliban ruled this country before the United States invaded. What we have seen since the negotiations with the Taliban is that they have not lived up to the commitment that they made in that treaty. So the idea that we're doing this in response to the negotiations, they've already breached those negotiations.
I'm going to jump in there because that's what critics are saying. Yes, there were tremendous gains made for women and against the Taliban over the past 20 years, but those have been sliding. And when you talk to women who say this has been going on for 40 years, they're referring, of course, to the Soviet war in Afghanistan. The Soviets also having to retreat. And there are some saying, and I'll play devil's advocate here, that, look, it's an intractable situation. There have to be other ways to go about this that don't bring in U.S. troops, which might even be a part of the problem, you know, provoking issues. We have to admit that a lot of those gains have been lost. The Taliban is rising. Women's rights are diminishing. That's worth admitting. And we got to go about this another way. What about that criticism?
Well, I appreciate that, and I think that was the reason for trying to start negotiations with the Taliban, which I supported. But if we are going to negotiate an agreement, the parties to that agreement have said certain things that they're going to comply with, and they don't, then we need to hold them accountable. And the fact is, the Taliban has not cut its ties with Al-Qaeda. They have continued violence within the country, and we've seen in the last couple of months a very deliberate assassination attack against particularly women. And one of the things that I pushed for during the previous administration was to try and get women at the table as part of those negotiations. We have a law in the United States that says, called Women, Peace, and Security, that says when we are in negotiations in those kinds of conflict areas, we will make it a priority to have women at the table. That was not done by the Trump administration.
Well, President Obama did draw down some troops out of Afghanistan in his second term, but he was unable to continue with the drawdown because of the Taliban. Are you worried that if troops leave now, there might be a collapse? But also, on the other hand, what would you do differently with the troops that are there now to prevent the slide that's already happening, the Taliban already gaining power, women already losing rights?
Well, I think that's happened because we have not been clear as part of our negotiations. And as long as they understood that they could wait us out, that they didn't have to be held accountable, we see now what the outcome of that is.
Right. What do you tell troops from your state who are hearing from President Biden, you know, their families are hearing they'll be coming home? Have you spoken with those families? Have those families contacted you? Do they want them home? And what do you tell them?
Well, I think everybody wants our troops home. But the question is, how do we do that in a way that doesn't undercut the effort that they've been fighting for? As somebody who remembers what it was like when we pulled out of Vietnam and we saw a civil war that incurred, I hope that we will continue to do everything we can to support the women and girls in Afghanistan and to provide assistance for the Afghan government as it fights the Taliban, because what we will almost certainly see is a civil war that ensues.
Senator Jean Shaheen, the Democrat from New Hampshire, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's face it, our world depends heavily on the internet to function. And there's a growing body that believes it has evolved from a luxury to a necessity. That's why President Biden's American Jobs Plan calls for $100 billion to connect every American to affordable high-speed internet. Here's Biden speaking last week.
Ask folks in rural America, where more than 35% of the people lack a reliable high-speed internet, limiting their ability to conduct business or engage in remote learning for their schools. Ask them whether investing in internet access will lead to better jobs in town, new markets for farmers, and better opportunities for their kids.
Will Mary Escoto is a U.S. policy analyst at Access Now, a nonprofit advocating for digital rights. And she joins us now for more on this. Welcome.
Thanks for having me, Tanya.
Well, Mary, how wide is the digital divide in the United States? And actually, how do we measure connectivity? Is it speeds, prices, access?
Well, it's really all of the above. And connectivity is more urgent than ever now. It can be the difference in getting a vaccine appointment, finding employment, or submitting homework assignments. Earlier, you said that it's more than 30 million Americans living in rural areas, and the numbers are varied. There's a study from Microsoft saying it was 157 million, and a Broadband Now saying it's 40 million. Mm-hmm. So right now, there are even more than 35% of rural Americans lacking access.
Biden's Federal Communications Commission says it wants to bridge this digital divide, and now the administration is calling for what sounds like a significant amount, as I mentioned, $100 billion. Where do you think that money should be best spent? And is it actually enough?
Well, I think $100 billion is excellent. The need to invest in not only broadband infrastructure, but lowering the barriers for municipal and community networks to be able to service customers is critical. So the money is being spent exactly where it needs to be.
Well, some conservative critics of federal broadband spending specifically say it's inefficient for the government to do this, and that it actually should be done through private providers instead. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, one thing is clear. Doing it through private investments hasn't gotten the job done, and we need a new approach. The emphasis on the federal government incentivizing and helping deploy broadband is long overdue. It's been essential infrastructure for years, if not decades. There have been way too many issues with pricing transparency. For too long, ISPs have gotten away with not disclosing their rates, even though they know exactly how much they charge. And this lack of transparency itself has made setting telecom policy extremely difficult. What Biden's plan is doing, it gives the message that big internet companies can be part of the solution, but they're not the only answer. When it comes to competitiveness and whether the federal government should be allocating funds to broadband, well, broadband is an essential infrastructure, and it's also a natural monopoly. We don't seek robust competition in the electricity market. Even if we were to have a genuinely competitive market, there would still be people who really can't afford it, and those people still need financial help to remain connected. Increasing competition among providers is good, and it can lead to price reductions, but we're unlikely to ever have a truly competitive broadband market. So prices will always be on the high side. So this plan emphasized infrastructure, but accessibility is another side of the coin. We want to shrink the number of people who need to use the subsidies, but I wouldn't be too quick to write off affordability concerns.
The White House is welcoming comparisons to the New Deal era. And specifically, this push for rural broadband harkens back to this 1936 Rural Electrification Act. Are there lessons from that program that we can apply to today?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that there are two issues at play here, right? So there's access and affordability. Biden's plan with emphasis on infrastructure, it addresses the former, and subsidy programs like the Emergency Broadband Benefit Program and the Lifeline Program, they address the latter. And so just because broadband is physically accessible doesn't mean it's affordable. So for millions of people who lack access to broadband infrastructure, Biden's plan would be transformative. That's undeniable. The bigger focus now is on allowing communities to really solve their broadband programs locally, ensuring that pricing transparency is available, and also ensuring that urban areas are fully covered, including low-income housing, not just rural.
That's Will Mary Escoto, a U.S. policy analyst at Access Now, a nonprofit advocating for digital rights. Will Mary, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Let's zoom in now for a closer look at one area where the lack of broadband availability is especially acute, and that's Native American tribal nations. Dara Blackwater is a member of the Navajo Nation and a law and policy fellow at the University of Arizona. She's been researching the digital divide there. And Dara began our conversation by saying hello in Navajo.
I am so happy to be here. Thank you so much.
Help us understand the scale of this problem. Who actually provides broadband services on tribal lands? What options do folks have? Is it a matter of affordability, or are there many people with no access whatsoever?
There are a lot of people with no access on tribal lands, especially when we're talking about rural tribal lands. There are only about 30% of people on rural tribal lands that do have access, which means, 70% don't. So that means that in a lot of places, nobody is providing it. But with this appropriation that was just given at the end of last year, it's through the Department of Commerce. They got $1 billion to create infrastructure and connect indigenous communities. And right now, they're asking all the questions of how do we empower Native nations to connect their citizens, because they have the sovereignty and the ability to do it, and now they'll have the funds to do it.
There is this new urgency for the necessity of broadband because of this pandemic. You wrote a piece last year headlined, "For Tribal Lands Ravaged by COVID-19, Broadband Access is a Matter of Life or Death." And is that still the case? Tell us what the impact of not having high-speed internet is right now for folks.
Yeah, it absolutely is the case. One of the main things that we talk about when we're talking about connectivity on tribal lands is the access to telehealth. I think about that for where I'm from, the Navajo Nation. You have to travel so far to get to a lot of medical institutions. And then, you're living oftentimes in multi-generational homes. So even if it's not the elders who are going out into the world to have to work, the people who are coming back to those homes, they're putting the elders at risk if they're all living together, which is very common.
Can you give us an example of what you found through your research, some tangible examples? I'm thinking about children and access to school during this pandemic. What are some of those specific examples that you found?
So I just had a really good conversation with this woman, Crystal Hottaway. She is spearheading the broadband expansion efforts at the Macaw tribe up in present-day Washington state. And they have a lot of really difficult challenges to navigate as far as their topography of their reservation. Their priority, stated by their tribal leadership, was education. And what they decided to do was do a mix of wireless connectivity while still trying to create partnerships that would bring fiber up their way. Fiber is obviously much harder to get because it's more expensive up front. And especially if you're in a really rocky area, digging the trenches to put fiber in can be really tough and really expensive and very slow. So they wanted to connect their kids because their alternative was to bus their children 40 minutes away down windy roads that can be very dangerous in order to let them take standardized tests that they had to be connected online in order to do. That was their catalyst to really connect their community. And they're doing great, great things up there now.
Do you think things will change now with this new infrastructure bill? Where would you like to see the money go?
So there are 574 different Native nations within America. There are even more unrecognized Native nations that are vying for recognition. And there are even more Native Hawaiian groups and Alaska Native groups. And there's no one solution, as these tribal leaders are tasked with figuring out how to connect their citizens. So where one might be starting at step one of, okay, it's time for us to see what we even need and bring in someone to do a feasibility study, whereas a lot of Native nations have already done that. They've applied for the spectrum a couple years ago, so they have a 2.5 gigahertz spectrum that they can use for a wireless network. But maybe now they're focusing on fiber, where they want redundancy, where if their wireless network goes down, they want to be able to bring fiber to their community for a longer, more sustainable, you know, cheaper connection, speaking over the next 20 years. So, you know, everyone is in a different spot, and that's why it's so important to have tribal consultations with leaders who, you know, can give that input and that insight.
That's Dara Blackwater, a member of the Navajo Nation and a law and policy fellow at the University of Arizona. Thank you so much for this conversation.
Ahiehe.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
On NPR's Consider This podcast, we don't just help you keep up with the news. We help you make sense of what's happening, like why the housing market is wild right now, what safe looks like once you're vaccinated, and how an increase in border crossings is testing the Biden administration. All of that in 15 minutes every weekday. Listen now to Consider This from NPR.
Hundreds of companies are speaking out against a wave of restrictive voting laws making their way through state legislatures across the country. Amazon, Starbucks, General Motors, and others signed a new statement that ran a full-page ad in the New York Times, the Washington Post, and other papers. The statement titled, "We Stand for Democracy," says it opposes discriminatory legislation that would make it harder for people to vote. Let's bring in MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi. Hi, Ali.
Hello, Tanya.
So this coalition was organized by former American Express CEO Kenneth Chenault and Merck CEO Kenneth Frazier, who also led a group of black executives in opposition to Georgia's voting law last month. What are these companies calling for?
Yeah, so last month it was 73 black executives, senior and former. Now it's gotten much broader than that. And they're calling on companies to get more involved in sort of being at the forefront of discriminatory legislation that would make it harder for people to vote around the country. So very specifically around the things that we're seeing in Georgia and Texas and Arizona and Michigan and Pennsylvania and, you know, a number of other states. But more broadly, to understand that taking a stand in favor of stronger civil rights and voting rights is not topic specific, because one of the things that companies get worried about is sort of topic specific advocacy. So I think what these leaders are saying is, let's say we're all in favor of more people voting and stronger voting rights and support that.
To that point, many companies put their names on the ad, while others, like executive Warren Buffett, signed personally but kept their businesses out of it. I'm guessing it's kind of connected to what you were just saying.
Yeah, look, companies are struggling with this. And by the way, they struggled with it a year ago with Black Lives Matter. What's politics and what's not? It you know, with Warren Buffett, it doesn't trouble me all that much, because Warren Buffett is so much the face of all his companies that when it's what I would be more worried if the companies did it and Warren Buffett didn't say so. In fact, Warren Buffett had said in 2018 that while he doesn't think businesses should be involved in politics, he said, "I didn't put my political views in a blind trust when I took the job. So I think there's a nuanced view there that he's walking a good line on. But there are some other companies that I think are going to run into some problems by not getting involved in this.
I have just about a minute with you, but Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell initially said companies should stay out of politics, but he's backed off of those comments. Now he says companies are entitled to political involvement. I mean, companies do donate a lot of money to political causes. Do you think these donations seem to face less scrutiny than public statements like this ad? And, yeah, and do you think that could change?
Yes. And I think we have to remember this, because between political action committees that are funded by companies, between donations that go to candidates, and between lobbying, companies have far more of a voice than the average voter does. So this concept, that statement by McConnell was an outlandish, unusual thing to say. I think there's a real discussion that needs to be had about what role companies should have in politics. But make no mistake, companies in America have probably got a louder voice than most voters do right now.
It will be really interesting as well to see how this debate could reshape the future of political giving as well. That's MSNBC. That's MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi. As always, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
When I say throat singing, many of you might think of the throat singers of Tuvan, descendants of herders in Tuva or Mongolia, who became sensations when their circular breathing singing techniques became known. Now, 22-year-old Shaina Novalinga is one of a handful of singers from her indigenous tribe, shifting the social media spotlight to Inuit throat singers of Canada. Last year, she posted a video of her and her mother throat singing on TikTok. Shaina Novalinga and her mother Caroline singing from their home in Montreal, Canada. Inuit throat singing was banned by Christian missionaries who saw it as inappropriate and the devil's voice. That ban was only lifted in the 1980s, and now Shaina and others are using social media to both preserve it and celebrate it. And Shaina Novalinga joins us from Montreal. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much. This is just, what a sound. Can, when you start first with, I know there's all sorts of different throat singing sounds. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about a couple of them that are in different parts of your throat and your face, literally? What mm-hmm. are they?
Yeah, of course. So there are different throat songs, and each throat songs have different meanings. We imitate the sound of nature and animals. Some of the songs don't involve the throat. For example, the love song, it's really just your voice. And then there's other songs that involves with the throat a lot more, like The Little Puppy, for example, the one we just listened to.
Oh, could you, The Little Puppy, could we hear it from you now?
Mm-hmm, of course. So The Little Puppy in our language, it's called Himmeholopi, and we are singing that in the song. So it goes like Himmeholopi, and we control the air coming in and the air coming out, so we know how to maintain when we sing.
Yeah. Can you give us another sound that might be higher pitched or in your nose more than your throat? Or,
mm-hmm. Like, for example, the love song, it's not with the throat. It would go like, So you see there's such a difference.
It's so funny. I have to tell you, that sounds exactly like an exercise that I do to try to keep my vocal flaps open.
Really? Yes, it helps calm people down. A lot of people say that.
That's what it does. It calms down your vocal flaps. Wow. Can we just have one more? A different, very distinct sound of using air?
So you see, right now, all I did was exhale, and then I'm going to inhale. So I'm very, I'm controlling it.
And we understand that the way this has been done, I mean, it's now become more of a performance, but the way that it's traditionally been done has been between two women?
Yes, traditionally, yes. But we encourage everyone to throat sing and to learn.
And what is it? It's kind of like a game of one-upping each other with techniques?
Exactly. So right now, my mother and I throat sing for fun. It's really just a pastime, but it's also a game. So, for example, some of the songs my mom is leading. I have to follow and make the exact same sound right after her. And we're playing a game to see who can keep up, who can throat sing the longest.
Tell us a little more about the history of it, because it was practiced despite the ban on it.
Yes, exactly. So like you mentioned, it was banned. We weren't allowed to throat sing. And luckily, there were four women in my community called Pauvonitouk, which is in northern Quebec, who knew how to throat sing. They were these four elders, and they encouraged them to pass it down to younger generations to keep that tradition alive. And my mother was actually one of the students of those elders, so she's considered a professional.
And so there's a game aspect to it, competition. There's ritual and history, and you say it's also about getting closer to nature. So I want to hear a little bit. Mm-hmm. This is you and your mother imitating the sound of geese. Shaina, it feels it could be almost trance-like. What does it feel like when you're, you know, in that rhythm?
I definitely feel a lot more connected with my roots, my ancestors, my culture. It feels very peaceful to throat sing with my mom. It's always so much fun.
Well, it also, to most ears, to many ears, parts of it will sound guttural. By guttural, I mean like a growling dog or, you know, something way down in your throat and way down in your chest. But it doesn't sound like it feels tense or anxious to you.
It doesn't? No, of course not. It's very different and unusual to many people. So a lot of people take it differently. But, you know, I've been posting a lot of throat singing videos this year. So a lot of people are getting used to it. And they're finally seeing the positivity coming out from it. And they see what we feel. So it's just so beautiful to have this kind of connection with everyone.
Well, we know you also have a love song. We can hear maybe a few seconds of that. Tell us first the song and its meaning.
Okay, so this love song, it's like I mentioned, it's not with the throat, and it goes like this. I can also sing with my throat in this song. It's a song that's a lot easier to sing for beginners. A lot of beginners use this song to practice. It's very calm.
And does it continue along that way that we just heard?
Yes, exactly. So the leader just makes the sound, and the follower has to follow. So whenever the leader wants to choose to change the sound, the follower has to follow.
What do you think, Shaina, about other Inuit throat singers? I'm thinking of Tanya Tagak.
Yes, it's amazing.
She had a hit with Björk, the Icelandic superstar. Let's listen. What do you think about this becoming, you know, international, but also entwined with an Icelandic singer like Björk? I mean, do you worry about it being appropriated?
No, of course. I think it's beautiful just to even just spread awareness about throat singing, to add her twist to her songs. I think it's beautiful.
Well, it's also spreading awareness about injustice against Indigenous peoples in Canada.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
In one of your posts, you shared about the missing and murdered Indigenous women. In 2016, Prime Minister Trudeau established the National Inquiry into these missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, concluding about 1,200 Aboriginal women had been murdered or gone missing since 1980. This is something you want people to know about as well.
Yes, of course. I grew up with a lot of women in my life, and they always taught me to be confident, strong, and they have taught me to also support other women. So I think it's very in my values and very important for me to help and uplift each other and just spread awareness about what's going on. And yeah, I think it's heartbreaking to know that this is happening still today.
So Shaina Novalinga, a couple million followers on TikTok, hundreds of thousands more on Instagram. You're a student now, but we understand that one of your plans is to have an album of throat singing?
Exactly, yes. It's Inuit throat singing, and some of our songs are traditional, so we didn't add anything. Some of the songs, we added some drums, and we kind of put a modern twist to it as well. But we're very excited. We really hope that the CD and the music that we made will help people cope with anxiety or what they're dealing with. And hopefully we'll keep our tradition alive as long as possible and teach other Indigenous youth to embrace their identity and wanting to make a change.
That is Inuit throat singer Shaina Novalinga from Montreal. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
No, thank you so much. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Today, the Biden administration announced the first major sanctions targeting the Russian economy in years, a response to the Kremlin cyber espionage campaign against the U.S. and its efforts to influence the presidential election. After June 14th, U.S. financial institutions will be barred from trading bonds used by the Russian government. Other measures include sanctioning six Russian tech companies believed to support state-backed cyber hacking and expelling 10 intelligence officers working under diplomatic cover in the United States. William Pomerantz is deputy director of the Wilson Center Kenan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies. Will, welcome back.
My pleasure.
Put this in perspective for us. How big of a deal are these sanctions?
I think they're a big deal in terms of the past couple days, because President Biden did reach out to President Putin in his phone call and talked about the need for a summit. He also said that he would be defending U.S. interests. And it will be interesting to see how Vladimir Putin and Russia responds to these new sanctions and whether they see this extended invitation by Biden as something that they won't want to follow up on.
Let's break this down a little bit, the restriction to buy Russian debt. What will this mean here in the U.S., and what could it mean for Russia's economy?
I've been following what the international traders have said, and basically their opinion is that it won't have a huge impact. U.S. financial institutions will not be able to buy Russian debt on the primary market, but in theory, they can buy it on the secondary market, and Russia doesn't have a lot of debt anyway. So It really is uncertain whether this will have a major impact on the Russian economy.
Okay. So the White House says it's responding to a number of seen and unseen actions by the Kremlin, including the hacking operation known as SolarWinds, which compromised 9 federal agencies and about 100 private firms. Can you remind us again about this?
Well, it was a very secret hacking, and we discovered it very late in the process. But it really compromised several U.S. government agencies and was very sophisticated in terms of how they hacked this information. Clearly, it was significant to produce this counter-reaction.
Mm-hmm. President Biden is also responding to the CIA's assessment that Russia offered to pay bounties to militants in Afghanistan to kill American troops, and of course, the effort to interfere with the presidential election. Are these measures enough to prevent, do you think, Russia from taking steps like these in the future?
We now have a lot of experience with sanctions against Russia. For the most part, while they've had an impact, it hasn't changed Russia's actions on the ground.
Yeah.
Obviously, the withdrawal of U.S. forces in Afghanistan will change that equation. But what we've learned about these sanctions, and they've been significant sanctions dealing with the financial and military and gas exploring sectors, what we've learned is Russia has been able to take the hit, as it were, and has not really changed Russian policy on the ground.
A senior administration official told NPR News that the White House has no desire to escalate with Russia. But we do know also in recent days that Russia has amassed tens of thousands of troops at the border with Ukraine, tanks and gunboats to the Black Sea. What do you think is behind this? Is Putin trying to signal to the Biden administration? I mean, could this be a real escalation, or could these sanctions push an escalation as retaliation? I understand what you're saying about sanctions and what they haven't done in the past.
It's unclear as to Russia's motives on the Ukrainian border. It might be that they want to escalate the conflict. It might be to determine how much support the United States would give to Ukraine. But clearly, one of the motives of these new sanctions is to somehow tell Russia that the United States will back its commitment to Ukraine. Biden had talked about promoting human rights as well. And we have introduced sanctions vis-a-vis the Navalny action. But these sanctions really don't address the question of human rights.
Before I let you go, Russia is important, as we know, geopolitically. It's also the fourth largest emitter of greenhouse gases. President Biden, back in March, reached out to Putin and invited him to the first big climate talks of the Biden administration later this month. Do you think these actions from the White House scuttle any hope for diplomacy on climate, at least in the short term?
Russia always responds to these actions. So if Biden wants to do a climate summit and wants Russia to participate, he has to give Russia some incentive to participate. And obviously, increasing sanctions and increasing the isolation of Russia is not an incentive to participate in these negotiations.
William Pomerantz is Deputy Director of the Wilson Center's Kenan Institute for Advanced Russian Studies. William, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.